Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, July 21st, 2022. Big Bend County judges say increased migrant activity and limited law enforcement prompted issuing of local disaster declarations by Sam Karras, Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Tri-County. Last week, both Presidio and Jeff Davis counties brought disaster declarations issued by their respective judges to a vote in Commissioner's Court. Jeff Davis County Commissioners tabled ratifying County Judge Curtis Evans' proclamation, citing legal concerns, but Presidio County forged ahead and ratified a declaration issued the week prior by County Judge Cinderella Guevara. Invoking Article 4, Section 7 of the Texas Constitution, Guevara's declaration, issued on July 6th, declares an invasion of the county thanks to unprecedented levels of illegal immigration. The document calls on Texas Governor Greg Abbott to also declare an invasion on the border with Mexico. In May 2021, Abbott issued a similar disaster declaration for 54 counties in Texas and renewed said declaration in August, amending the declaration to cull several counties on his list. Under Section 418 of the Texas Government Code, issuing a disaster declaration expands some of the county judge's powers. If detailed in the county's emergency management plan, the county can charge fines and jail time for failure to comply with an emergency declaration. The judge may also order an evacuation of the county or take measures to control ingress and egress from their jurisdiction at the county line. Judge Guevara previously issued a disaster proclamation to combat the COVID-19 pandemic. The county is currently under a state proclamation for drought. Judge Guevara explained the difference between her two disaster proclamations, issued a little over a year apart. The one we did last year signed onto the governor's. In that one, we weren't declaring an invasion, she said. That one was just asking that the sovereignty and territorial integrity of our borders not be violated anymore by illegal immigration. This one is different because several counties are declaring an invasion. At last week's meeting of the Presidio County Commissioner's Court, Presidio County Sheriff's Department Chief Deputy Joel Nunez gave a presentation on the challenges his department faces patrolling the vast remote reaches of the county. Nunez reported that since January 2020, 340 undocumented individuals had been apprehended within the PCSO's jurisdiction. It's just not acceptable, Judge Guevara said in response to Nunez's presentation. Though this round wasn't initiated by the governor, she's still hoping that the proclamation will earn attention, money, and resources from larger entities and fill perceived gaps in local law enforcement. I didn't hesitate to issue a declaration of local disaster under my own authority, Guevara told the Big Bend Sentinel. That helps us right away. We've already declared an emergency, and that helps open us up for federal funding or state funding. It was not immediately clear what material or financial benefits the declaration would bring. Governor Abbott's office did not return a request for comment on the matter. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, did report a more than triple jump in numbers of single adults attempting to cross the border in 2020, but 2020 was also the year the agency adopted Title 42 measures in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Title 42 calls for the immediate expulsion of migrants rather than holding them in detention centers. After Title 42, the agency saw a 27% recidivism rate, suggesting that the agency's pandemic-era statistics reflect a large number of repeat border crossers rather than a true surge in migration. So far this fiscal year, CBP has reported a 6.5% decrease in encounters for the Big Bend sector, which saw the least migrant traffic of any CBP sector in the Southwest, about half of the next least busy sector, California's El Centro. The Big Bend sector is responsible for the largest geographical area of any sector along the Southwest border, the agency's website proclaims. Nunez's count of undocumented migrants, 340 in 2.5 years, may put Presidio County toward the bottom of the pack. The agency doesn't officially keep track of encounters by county, but for scale, the city of Van Horn in Culberson County also issued a disaster proclamation during last spring's wave of immigration disaster proclamations. The week Van Horn's proclamation was released, CBP agents apprehended 115 migrants in a single encounter just outside city limits. Guevara was grateful to Deputy Nunez for providing the commissioners with local statistics and anecdotes. Both officials feel it's a problem of scale. The PCSO has 4 deputies compared to dozens of Border Patrol agents who cover the same terrain. It was really eye-opening because we don't see it happening, but it is happening, she said. The very same thing you see on national news is happening here in Presidio County, but it isn't on the news. As a lifelong resident of Presidio County, Guevara has seen conditions on the border change through numerous administrations, local and national. I do believe that it does have to do with the Biden administration saying they will not build a wall. I feel like there used to be more control over our borders, she said, referencing the fact that President Biden suspended construction on the border wall his first day in office. He also chose to keep Title 42 in place. I feel like migrants took it as an invitation, like, come on in, we're going to welcome you. We're going to be able to take care of you. That's not the case. Jeff Davis County Judge Curtis Evans echoed Guevara's sentiments. Evans was inspired to issue his proclamation after getting in touch with Kinney County Judge Telly Shahan. He also noted that Val Verde County and the city of Uvalde had also issued similar declarations. This is definitely something that's going to help the area to secure our border, he said. The Jeff Davis County Commissioner's Court ultimately voted to table ratifying Evans' proclamation until the state attorney general could sign off on the legality of the measure. We want to make sure we're not like a chihuahua barking. We want to make sure this thing has some teeth, Evans said. Evans has lived in Fort Davis since 1982 and feels like policing immigration is more of a challenge than it's ever been. It's way worse, he said. We're not getting the workforce that is needed anymore. It's mainly drug runners. There's more break-ins. There's more destruction. It's not like it used to be. Valentine seems to be the hub of immigration activity in Jeff Davis County. Evans cited an incident in 2021 when a structure on the Miller Ranch was set on fire by a migrant in distress, hoping to attract attention from emergency personnel. We should be able to rely on our federal government because this is a federal issue, he said. The feds are not doing their job, and they're putting all of the burden on these rural counties. We can't afford it. Presidio County Attorney Rod Ponton wasn't consulted on the emergency proclamation before it was issued. From the perspective of county officials, there's a slight increase in state-charged alien smuggling under state law, but it's a slight increase, not an avalanche, he explained. These statistics may in part have inflated because the governor's office made it easier to arrest people accused of human smuggling as a part of last year's Operation Lone Star initiative. Though Ponton pushed back on immigration statistics offered by local officials, he echoed their hopes that immigration crimes be primarily a federal concern. Neither the DA nor myself or the sheriff really want to be dealing with immigration offenses, he said. Federal national policy is basically letting the word out to the streets of the world to come to the U.S. Guevara, Evans, and other local officials are hoping that their call to arms will aid their counties in getting the help they need to deal with immigration offenses. Now the governor can ask the federal government to send additional assistance, Guevara said. I think Abbott has been very proactive and not reactive. I think he has done everything in his power to secure the border here in Texas. Community members, alumni, gathered to exchange views over the Blackwell School's pending National Historic Site designation. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. Marfa. In a community meeting held last Sunday at the USO building, Blackwell School alumni, descendants, members of the Blackwell School Alliance, staff representing the National Parks Conservation Association, and more came together to discuss the history, challenges, and concerns associated with the school being designated as a National Historic Site, a recognition which has yet to be signed into law. Opened from 1909 to 1965, the Blackwell School was a segregated school for Mexican-American students, which, unlike similar sites across the state, is still standing and was listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 2019. Its proponents are looking toward the future of the one-room adobe schoolhouse entering the federal park system, allowing it to serve as an important reminder of the contemporary experience of Mexican Americans in the greater U.S. for future generations. Everybody that is here today is making history, said Blackwell alumnus Sam Cobos of the occasion, addressing the gathered crowd of around 40 people. After lunch from Convenience West and before kicking off roundtable group activities, the president of the Blackwell School Alliance, Gretel Enck, welcomed participants and provided an update on the building's designation. The formal designation of the school as a National Historic Site passed both the House and Senate, she said, but due to an amendment to the bill, it wasn't quite across the finish line. She said they are hopeful the political will and bipartisan support of congressional leaders backing the bill will see the president's signature mark the final approval sometime this summer, but encouraged everyone to reach out to Texas Representative Tony Gonzalez to urge the process along. University of Texas El Paso Professor Dr. Frank Pettis, author of Deconstructing Eurocentric Tourism and Heritage Narratives in Mexican-American Communities, acted as the meeting's facilitator, introducing all who gathered to the concept of cultural heritage tourism. Pettis said it is important that the future Blackwell site share the stories and voices of as many people as possible while addressing the difficulties and ramifications of the separate but equal doctrine. Pettis prompted the various small groups to talk over who they imagined visiting the Blackwell School and the main takeaways they want guests to glean from the site. At each table, groups started conversations by sharing their memories of Blackwell. Alumni shared uplifting recollections of school reunions, as well as more painful stories of corporal punishment and discrimination. Many touched on the repression of the Spanish language. In 1954, students were barred from speaking Spanish on campus, and impacts that had on their lives. The collective memories were full of emotional highs and lows. Feelings of repression were coupled with feelings of gratitude for kind teachers and athletic and band programs. Newer Marfa residents shared their first impressions of the Blackwell School site and emphasized the need for further education on the history of segregated Mexican-American schools, recalling no mention of such history in their textbooks growing up. Alumni present represented different eras of the school, with Lionel Salgado, who attended from 1941 to 1951, sitting alongside Cobos, who attended Blackwell at the tail end of its operation in the 60s, and recalled how the civil rights movement influenced his perception of his school experience. In an interview with the Big Bend Sentinel, Cobos said the work he and others have put in throughout their lifetime to educate people about the history of the Blackwell School, as well as the discrimination and unequal treatment of people of color, was finally paying off, with the pending National Historic Site designation promising to lift up the story of Blackwell and similar institutions, reaching a larger audience than ever before. If you don't work to put stories of racial discrimination out there, it will disappear, and then we're at risk of things like that happening again because people don't understand, said Cobos. Making Blackwell a National Historic Site opens the doors to spread the stories to the whole nation and other countries. You can't ask for a better platform. After a short break in which attendees snacked on a festive Blackwell-themed cake, further discussion ensued, focusing on the increase in tourism that the National Historic Site would bring to Marfa and compounding effects to the neighborhood experience, traffic, and more. Some residents raised concerns about the lack of public bathrooms and other services for tourists, and how to provide more parking for Blackwell School visitors who could be patronizing the site 7 days a week. Others worried the formal designation of the site would cause their property taxes to increase. Most agreed the influx of school field trips and history buffs visiting Blackwell would be beneficial for the local businesses and hotels. Some brainstormed ideas for how to fold the art community into the mix and ensure signage around town pointed people to visit Blackwell. A primary theme was how increased visitation to the Blackwell School as a result of it becoming a National Historic Site would help diversify the town's predominant arts tourism. Visitors to Blackwell would be able to formulate a more complete history of the town of Marfa by gaining exposure to the town's earlier history, as opposed to just the traditionally celebrated Judd era of the 1970s and beyond. Many brought up the need to present a comprehensive, rather than siloed, history of the Blackwell School, which touches on current issues, like the role of Marfa's railroad tracks as racial and socioeconomic boundaries, for example. Some said the Blackwell site should touch on the area's broader cultural heritage, including its border and military influences. Underscoring the need for the preservation of Marfa's heritage, one Blackwell alumnus expressed their disappointment at the lack of meeting attendance among the town's younger populations. Carrie Dupuy, Texas Regional Director for the National Parks Conservation Association, NPCA, whose organization has been assisting the Alliance throughout the 3-year process of becoming a federally listed historic site, said the recognition of the Blackwell School would be a monumental step in addressing the modern history of America's Latinx population, whose stories have traditionally been underrepresented within the national park system. The only other similar site being the Cesar E. Chavez National Monument in California. Segregated schools for Mexican-American students existed throughout Texas and the Big Bend region, including the Hidalgo Ward School in Marathon and the Centennial School in Alpine. We're so excited to be here today. We thought it was just an absolutely fabulous conversation to continue to lift up the Blackwell experience and the Blackwell stories, said Dupuy in an interview with the Big Bend Sentinel after the event. This is a story that's relevant to not just Marfa or Texas, but all across the Southwest. This has opened the door for us to interpret the Hispanic and Latino experience across the country, added Kyle Grudzinger, communications manager with the NPCA. Grudzinger said presenting the diversity of stories and varied experiences of Blackwell students at the site will be a challenge, but they intend to work with the Alliance to present the history in a complex and detailed way. Unlike some older historic sites, the Blackwell School has survived alumni. Unlike some older historic sites, the Blackwell School has surviving alumni who are able to share their stories firsthand, he said. Cristobal Lopez, an intern with the NPCA, is working to archive previously collected oral histories and conduct more interviews in both English and Spanish to add to the archive. He said oral histories are some of the most important historical archives a site can maintain, offering more personal and vivid recollections of the past compared to print material. It's about the people who were there. It's themselves. It's their voices. And that just adds an entirely different element than just reading a report or a letter, said Lopez. Being able to actually hear their voices and emotions. Dupuy noted the process of the Blackwell School becoming a National Historic Site is only just beginning, and the NPCA will continue to work with the National Park Service to address community needs and concerns for the site. We are so close to getting actually designated, but getting that signature by the president is really just a start, said Dupuy. As a national park site, this will be like all other national parks across the country who need funding, staffing, and support. Inc. wrapped up the meeting by thanking all who participated and ensuring them that the Blackwell School Alliance, which was formed in 2006, would remain intact in the future, likely shifting their focus from National Historic Site designation to education and community outreach. A friends group, which focuses on fundraising, could also be formed, she said. The successful transferring of the Blackwell School into a National Historic Site hinges on the steadfast commitment from the local community, she said. While all parties align on the need for historic preservation of the Blackwell School, its alumni, descendants, and advocates, not the National Park Service, truly know the ins and outs of its history, she said. This is why, as much as we can moving forward, and as many opportunities as we have, we need to stay involved and make sure we help steer the ship as the Park Service goes forward, said Inc. Change can be hard, even if it's good. To call Texas Representative Tony Gonzalez and relay support for the Blackwell School becoming a National Historic Site, call 202-225-4511. Marfa School Board accepts resignation of board member Krista Marquez, discusses start of school year, salary structures for support staff at latest meeting. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa, school board members met Monday for a brief meeting in which they accepted the resignation of board member Krista Marquez, reviewed plans for the upcoming school year, and assessed salary structures for the district's staff. Superintendent Oscar Aguero was present, as were board members Lori Flores, Renee Gonzalez, Teresa Nunez, Yolanda Jurado, Ruben Martinez, and Ernie Villarreal. Aguero, in delivering his superintendent's report, said that at the moment the district had enough teachers employed to start school, but would ideally still like to bring on a reading and math interventionist and a secondary social studies teacher/coach. He said despite spreading the word and contacting people around the state, the district wasn't having much success in receiving job applications, which he attributed to a statewide worker shortage in the field of education. "It's all across the state. It's not just us," said Aguero. Next, the board went over various security updates, including a letter from Governor Greg Abbott to the TEA, which states schools must perform weekly checks of exterior doors. High school principal Lou Ann Porter said school staff were continuing to meet with local law enforcement to review the campus buildings. "This coming school year," said Aguero, "the school will have a new professional development program for staff hosted by the Colorado-based foundation, I Love You Guys, which will visit the school to train staff on standard response protocol or how to respond to an active threat situation, thanks to funding provided by the Marfa Education Foundation." Aguero updated the board on his meeting the previous week with city council members, in which the city agreed to partner with the school to hire a school resource officer, SRO, regardless of whether or not the city is awarded grant funding for the position. Aguero explained that the SRO would only work during the school year and would perform foot patrols of the campus buildings and exterior. Gonzalez asked whether the school might be able to provide the officer with a golf cart so they could more easily get around campus, to which Aguero said that was a possibility. Gerardo addressed the school staff, wondering if clear backpacks were going to be a requirement this coming year, in addition to the regular list of school supplies, which was recently made available on the district's website. Porter said she supported the idea of transparent backpacks, which some school districts, including Dallas ISD, are requiring for the coming school year as extra safety precautions, but was unsure how readily available they were. Due to supply chain issues, Aguero said it wouldn't be fair to require parents to purchase clear backpacks with schools starting in just 1 month. After approving two budget amendments, Villarreal asked about the status of auditorium renovation campaign funds. Aguero said donations weren't pouring in, but they had received a recent donation from the class of 72 for $2,400 and were continuing to accept contributions. The first item under new business was to discuss the resignation of Krista Marquez from the school board. Marquez served on the board for just over 2 years. Her seat, place one, will be up for re-election this coming May. Board members went back and forth on whether or not to replace Marquez or simply let the seat remain vacant until the election in May of 2023. Aguero recommended not appointing a new member, stating the current board had momentum and attempting to open up letters of interest, select a candidate, and train them before the school year starts on August 17th would be a challenge. Plus, it would be a challenging time for a new board member to start. The board is currently in talks to put a bond on the ballot in the upcoming November election to fund an overhaul of campus facilities. "I like the dynamic of our current board, and I'm not sure bringing in someone so close to the bond election would affect our dynamic," said Villarreal. "It's a hard time to be on the board. We're about to ask the community for a tough decision," Aguero added, referring to the bond election. Gerardo said she agreed, but felt like the board owed it to the public to open up letters of interest. "I do understand the dynamic, and I love the dynamic. I know it's a critical time because of the bond, but I'm also thinking of the public and school as a whole, and we're a board of seven," said Gerardo. who also agreed to having someone go through all the necessary training. Just to have to run for a re-election in May was a tough sell. Marquez also serves as one of the district's representatives on the Presidio County Appraisal District Board, in addition to Nunez. School board members worried if Marquez decided to roll off of the PCAD board as well, they would lose their two-member voice on the board and might have to give it up to another entity. They may choose to recall her from the position at a later date, but did not yet move to do so. In the end, the majority of the board voted not to fill Marquez's seat, with only Jurado voting against the decision. Marquez did not respond to a request for comment from the Big Bend Sentinel regarding her resignation. Lastly, the board reviewed structures for staff salaries, which were originally presented to them in June. Some board members argued for greater transparency for the salaries of custodians and aides, stating they should be on a step system based on years served, similar to the teaching staff. After some back and forth, the board voted to approve the compensation plan for teachers, nurses, counselors, and administrative personnel, and will meet for a brief meeting next week to solidify the plans for maintenance and paraprofessional staff. The regular board meeting was then followed by a community bond meeting. The Big Bend Sentinel's coverage of that meeting can also be found in the July 21st, 2022 issue of the newspaper. School board hosts second community bond meeting, Urges Need for Greater Public Participation, by Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL, at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. The Marfa Independent School District Board held a community bond workshop on Monday, the second in a series of meetings, to gather public feedback about a bond proposal the district is planning to put up for a vote in the November 8th general election. Attendees, including City Council Member Mark Cash, members from the Marfa Police Department, community members Jay Foster and Ann Dunlap, Fire Chief Gary Mitschke, parent Vince Fuentes, district staff, and more funneled in and were given bond campaign calendars as MISD board members taped design proposals to the whiteboard. In the initial public meeting, local teachers, parents, and community members took a tour of campus facilities and by and large agreed a bond for infrastructure upgrades was needed. The second meeting saw fewer community members coming to a similar conclusion and discussing how to overcome public skepticism of the bond. "We need to come back and refocus on how we get this bond passed," said Board President Teresa Nunez. "We need to assess our needs so we can get the information out to the public. The district can ask for up to $45 million for the bond and must call the bond election by a deadline of August 22nd. The school board and Claycom Associates, as architects, who the district is partnering with on the board planning process, have presented three primary options for a reimagined MISD campus to community members, all of which involve building a new K-12 school somewhere on the district's grounds, and range in cost from $39 to $44 million. Board members have reached a general consensus that a new school is needed, with many favoring the $44 million option that would see a single-story K-12 campus constructed where the existing elementary school and Shorthorn Gym sit. The building would measure 90,000 square feet and hold up to 300 students, with construction estimated to take around 18 to 20 months. But as many board members stated in Monday night's meeting, the public needed to reach their own consensus, which in an ideal world would align with the board's. "I do believe that it is going to be too expensive to try to repair some campus facilities when it's probably cheaper to go totally new," said Superintendent Oscar Aguero. In the past, proponents said a new singular K-12 building would allow for tighter security, cutting down on the number of buildings the students walk to every day, and the installation of new technologically advanced classrooms, which could attract more students and teachers to become Shorthorns. The current patchwork campus consists of 8 buildings constructed and renovated across decades. A frequent topic of discussion among the school board and community at bond meetings has been the lack of a master plan, which could have proved helpful in the past and would be integral in steering the future development of the district's facilities and land holdings. All new preliminary design plans act somewhat as master planning documents and involve the renovation and demolition of a number of MISD buildings. Since construction on a new campus could last 2 to 3 years, according to Claycomb architect Francis Zordilla, the district will have to figure out a way to reconfigure existing facilities to educate students in the event the elementary school is torn down to make way for a new K-12 campus, for example. We're trying to master plan each of these options so that you guys can grow in the future as well, said Zordilla. It is likely that the district will have to phase those additional upgrades and go out for more bonds in the future to pay for them. The $44 million campus plan, for example, with renovations, demolitions, and the new campus, would cost around $59 million total in today's dollars. Mike Rhodes, education consultant with Claycomb, said because school bonds have to be paid off within a certain time period, the district would have the capacity to borrow more funds in the future. So as those debts fall off, that creates capacity to issue more of the approved bonds by the voters, said Rhodes. The school board is still paying back a 2007 bond, in which voters approved $2,900,000 for 2 new gymnasiums. When asked how much money the district still had to pay off for those previous loans, Aguero said he wasn't sure, but that they were continuously making payments. Now, Aguero clarified further that an increase in school property taxes needed to pay for the bond would not affect the primary residences of those 65 and older with homestead exemptions unless they added square footage onto their property. Another long-term goal of the district, to provide more teacher housing, was addressed in the latest design schemes presented at the meeting, suggesting the placement of a number of mobile homes on the land where the elementary parking lot currently exists. But the idea of using that particular space was ultimately nixed for a number of reasons, primarily because the site once held old homes that were torn down and buried in a hole underneath the lot. Dunlap, a permit specialist with the city of Marfa, said studies would likely need to be conducted on the site if it were to be transformed, and citizens aware of the site's past might raise concerns over the health of re-exposing asbestos and more. In the middle of your bond, which is going to be a political issue in our town, I don't know if you want to reintroduce the problem of what's below that asphalt, said Dunlap. Fuentes agreed, stating even the aesthetics of the mobile homes in the area would likely turn citizens against the bond. He wondered whether the school campus could expand and utilize the wide North Gonzales Street, which others said was an interesting idea, but would involve a complicated process with the city. Mitschke said without the street there, it may also block fire truck access to district facilities in the event of an emergency. If you create animosity, ill will, unnecessary drama, or conflicts, you put yourself in a position where the bond's not passable, said Rhodes, warning community members to weigh thinking outside of the box with feasibility. Board member Renee Gonzalez called on Marfa PD officer Gilberto Carrillo to share with the group the security concerns and challenges the current school facilities pose for incoming law enforcement officers. Carrillo said the buildings contain a number of dead ends and blind spots, and pose security risks due to the number of entrances and exits. Still, Marfa PD will continue to work with other law enforcement to train in the facilities in the event of an active threat situation, he said. Mitschke, meanwhile, said the number of exits may be a positive in the case of a fire, and the elementary school being concrete means the building would likely survive. Fuentes, who also specializes in commercial air conditioning, ventilation, and indoor air quality, was concerned after hearing about the physical reactions of coughing and watery eyes that some people experienced during the last bond meeting's tour of campus facilities. If mold were present, he said, people should be worried for the health of their children, and it could be a liability issue. He wondered what the theoretical argument would be for preserving existing facilities, saying that option seemed like it would do little more than lipstick the pig. The whole remodel concept has just been past the buck for how many decades? Look at it now, said Fuentes. I'm sure it was done as best people could do back then. I'm not going to blame them or anything, but that's enough. Foster, who has been keeping an ear to the ground for local feedback, said he encountered one person in the community who calculated the price per student for the bond project using the cost of construction divided by school's current enrollment, and the high dollar amount turned that logo against the bond project. Rhodes responded, stating that was an unfair characterization of the numbers. The bond-funded new school would not just serve 250 kids, for example, but thousands over generations, as the building should last 50 years or more, he said. It really boils down to whatever you do, it's going to cost you something, said Rhodes. It's creating awareness of the need. People drive by these buildings. They don't know what they look like. They don't know what they smell like. I mean, we're coughing. Our eyes are burning. They don't know that. They're driving down the road. Public misconceptions were a real issue, Fuentes said, who'd heard rumors the new track wasn't regulation size, to which Gonzalez assured him it was. He continued, stating public concern for the new track's price tag seemed to go away once the community started utilizing the recreational area. That's why we built it, said Gonzalez. We are trying to get the community involved. Many board members said they hoped for a greater turnout from the public at the next bond workshop, which is scheduled for 5 p.m., Monday, August 1st. Nunez encouraged those who could not attend to email school board members with their feedback and reminded everyone school staff would be available to host tours of the campuses for anyone interested. We just need to get the word out there, said Nunez. Our children need it. Marfa's future needs it. Come to our meetings. Don't be afraid. Just come and talk to us.
Hello. I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, July 14th. Ward County Grand Jury indicts Mississippi man on manslaughter and negligent homicide charges. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A grand jury indicted a Mississippi man on two counts of criminally negligent homicide, a state jail felony, and two counts of manslaughter, a second-degree felony, for a crash he was involved in, which killed two people in February 2020. The indictments were handed down by the grand jury of the 143rd Judicial District Court on May 5th. According to court documents, Matthew Cade McKenzie, age 22, of Canton, Mississippi, was driving a 2017 Ford F-250 pickup eastbound on Business 20 near Barstow, just before 7:30 a.m. on February 10, 2020, when he allegedly failed to drive in a single lane of traffic and veered into the westbound lane, hitting a 2019 Nissan Titan driven by Horacio Acosta Ramirez, age 37, of El Paso, head-on. The crash killed Acosta Ramirez and his passenger, Renee M. Cruz, age 55, of Odessa. Ward County Precinct 1 Justice of the Peace Elizabeth Polanco pronounced Acosta Ramirez dead at the scene, while Cruz was pronounced dead by Reeves County Precinct 2 Justice of the Peace Jim Riley. At the time of the crash, McKenzie admitted to Texas Department of Public Safety troopers on the scene that he fell asleep while traveling toward Barstow on business I-20. McKenzie was transported to Reeves County Hospital by Pecos EMS. According to Sergeant Oscar Villarreal, former Safety Education and Media Communications for Texas Highway Patrol, the trooper observed some raw marijuana in a glass jar inside of McKenzie's vehicle, which prompted a blood test to be taken at Reeves County Hospital. Quote, "The results of the blood test showed McKenzie to be under the influence of marijuana and cocaine at the time of the crash," he added. Villarreal said both Acosta Ramirez and Cruz were wearing seatbelts at the time of the crash, as were McKenzie and three passengers with him in the Ford pickup, identified as Brandon Manuel, age 33, of Cave City, Arkansas, Jeremy Robinson, age 36, of Tumsua, Mississippi, and Deontay Williams, age 24, of Greenville, Mississippi. Manuel, Robinson, and Williams all were taken to Medical Center Hospital in Odessa, but with what were described as non-incapacitating injuries. McKenzie was booked into the Ward County Jail on July 11th for the Ward County warrants. Bond was set at $5,000 for each charge. McKenzie posted the $20,000 bond and was released on July 12th. The offense can be punishable by imprisonment in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for any term of not more than 20 years or less than 2 years, and a fine not to exceed $10,000. Grand Falls man booked for assaulting girlfriend and child. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A 30-year-old Grand Falls man was arrested last Thursday afternoon after an unknown incident between the suspect and his girlfriend allegedly led to violence at their home in the 600 block of 3rd Street in Grand Falls. According to Ward County Sheriff Frerin Valle, quote, "It was around 12:30 p.m. when deputies were dispatched to the home in reference to an assault," end quote. During the investigation, deputies learned the suspect, identified as Christopher Devon Spencer, assaulted his girlfriend and a child under the age of 14. Quote, "Deputies also discovered during the assault Spencer had placed a child under the age of 14 in danger," Valle said. It was later determined the suspect was living at the same residence as both victims, and Spencer was subsequently arrested and charged with assault family violence with previous conviction, a third-degree felony, injury to a child, a third-degree felony, and endangering and abandoning a child, a third-degree felony. Bond for Spencer was set at $5,000 for each charge, and he was released after posting the $10,000 bond. The offense can be punishable by imprisonment in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for any term of not more than 10 years or less than 2 years, and a fine not to exceed $10,000. Commissioners help Monahans Volunteer Fire Department purchase training equipment. The story was written by Jan Cranfield. The Ward County Commissioners met Monday morning and considered approving a request by Monahans Volunteer Fire Department Chief Randy Crabtree for help with purchasing a piece of training equipment. Randy Crabtree was present at the meeting and asked for the county's help in obtaining the remaining funds to purchase a training door. Crabtree explained to the court, "The training door is an actual door mounted on a skid frame and can be set up to simulate any closed or locked door situation that might be encountered at a fire location." Quote, "Our firefighters can practice many dangerous scenarios with this door and the complete safety of the firehouse," Crabtree said. the fire department obtained a grant for $10,000 from the Texas Forest Service to go toward the purchase of the training device, and the commissioners approved another $2,500 to complete the amount needed. Quote, any of our law enforcement agencies have a standing invitation to come to the firehouse and practice with the door. Two people are all that is needed to perform training exercises with the training door, Crabtree said. Crabtree also gave the court an update on the training course held at the Ward County Event Center this past weekend. MV Fire Rescue, a professional firefighting training company based in San Antonio, gave local and visiting firefighters a 16-hour training course designed to improve the proficiency rate of volunteer fire departments and personal skills of full-time firefighters. This training session was for first-line engine ops with training tips on being the first on site and having the first hose off the truck, professional training of truck pump pressures and water flow rates, gallons per minute, through the hoses that are designed to make firefighting more efficient. The firefighters also learned new techniques for bringing a hose into a fire, new and safer ways to pull and drag fire hoses, Crabtree said. Nine local volunteer firefighters and nine out-of-town firefighters took part in the two-day training. The out-of-town participants were from Seminole, Fabens, Odessa, and Midland. Quote, it was a tough training weekend, but very successful in what we learned, Crabtree said. In another agenda item, the commissioners approved and welcomed Mickey Mitchell to the Ward County Hospital Board. As a newly appointed board manager, Mitchell will be fulfilling the unexpired term of Tommy Escamilla. Quote, Mickey Mitchell will be an asset for the hospital, and we are happy to have him agree to take the position, Precinct 2 County Commissioner Larry Hanna said. In other business, the commissioners approved new county personnel hires. Also approved by the commissioners was accepting the bid submitted by Mario Rubio for a paving project in Precinct 3, which will involve County Roads 27 and 29. Present for the meeting were Precinct 1 Commissioner Tino Sanchez, Precinct 2 Commissioner Larry Hanna, Precinct 3 Commissioner Dexter Nichols, and Judge Greg Holly. Precinct 4 Commissioner Eddie Nelms was not present for the meeting. The next Ward County Commissioners meeting will be at 9:30 a.m. on July 25th in the County Courthouse at 400 South Allen Street. Council allocates hot funds. Public hearing set for city budget. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Monahan City Council met in regular session on Tuesday afternoon and approved the allocation of the 2022-2023 Hotel Motel Occupancy Tax Funds, also known as HOT Funds. Funding available in the HOT Fund to begin the next fiscal year is around $1.9 million. The council heard requests from Chamber of Commerce Director Teresa Burnett and Ward County Judge Greg Holly for the Million Barrel Museum and Ward County Event Center, as well as Assistant City Manager Frank Heslin on behalf of the Sands Art Association during the last council meeting. Burnett told the council that her proposed budget was about the same as last year's budget, with the addition of funding for a new software program which is more conducive in coordinating events, advertising, and day-to-day operations of the chamber. The chamber requested approximately $177,000, which included money to partially offset administration expenses, as well as for advertising and support of events, bringing new events to town, and help grow the community. Ward County Judge Greg Holly told councilmen that the county did not want to compete with any other entity, but if funds were sufficient, they have requested $400,000 for the event center and $50,000 to help fund the Million Barrel Museum complex. Assistant City Manager Frank Heslin spoke to the council on behalf of the Sands Art Association and their building located at 1000 North Main. The building has a historical marker and was originally the Christ the King Catholic Church, built in 1938. In the mid-1960s, the Sands Art Association assumed the building for a place to hold art workshops, exhibits, and craft shows. The building is in dire need of restoration repairs. The council approved the allocation of funding for the fiscal year as follows: up to $50,000 for the museum complex, Ward County, up to $176,000 to the Monahans Chamber of Commerce, up to $1,500 for the airport fly-in, up to $7,000 for sundry administration, $50,000 special projects, meetings, $12,000 City of Monahans, utilities for a million-barrel museum, $25,000 City of Monahans existing sports facilities and fields, and $400,000 for the Ward County Event Center infrastructure activities, and $40,000 for historical restoration and preservation. Present for the meeting was City Manager Rex Thee, Mayor Adam Steen, and City Councilman Jeppy Wilson, Richard Hawkins, Rudy Hernandez, Calvin Carroll, and Ivy Valenzuela, and Attorney Justin Till were all in attendance. In regular business, a public hearing has been set regarding the proposed 2022-2023 city budget for August 23rd at 3 p.m. in the council chambers at City Hall. A copy of the proposed budget can be inspected at City Hall within 10 business days of the public hearing or viewed online on the City of Monahans website. In other actionable items, a grazing pasture lease between the city and former Chief of Police Billy Riley was also approved by the council. Thee said, quote, "This is a grazing lease for an area in and around the landfill that the city owns. Mr. Riley has had the grazing lease for several years," end quote. The lease states Riley will pay the city $8 per month per head of livestock with a minimum of 20 head. Any additional livestock will be prorated per month per head with a maximum of 50 head. In regular business, the June accounts payable was approved by the council, totaling $910,000. The June monthly departmental reports and minutes were also approved by the city council. Council members convened an executive session at the end of the meeting to discuss deliberations regarding the appointment of MEDC board member unexpired term ending September 30, 2023, and appointments to the Planning and Zoning Board, three members and one alternate. After reconvening into regular session, Thee said council members decided to appoint Kathy Anthony to the MEDC board and reappoint Mickey Mitchell and Joni King to the Planning and Zoning Board. Chris Lanice was appointed from an alternate to a member, and Raul Sestea was appointed to the board as an alternate. All appointments are subject to the acceptance of the appointee. The next city council meeting will be held at 3 p.m. on Tuesday, July 26th, in the council chambers at City Hall at 112 West 2nd Street. City landfill pit catches fire. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Smoke filled the air at the city landfill northwest of Monahans Monday morning around 11 a.m. after some debris caught fire. Members of the Monahans Volunteer Fire Department responded to the call for help, which sent thick black smoke billowing into the sky. Municipal Solid Waste Superintendent John Romo said, quote, "Landfill operator Aaron Rodriguez noticed the smoke around 10:45 a.m. and called me. I checked the cameras and could see the black smoke and then called the fire department." The fire began in pit number 4, which is used for city residents to dump furniture, construction waste, or basically anything other than food waste. Quote, The pit is 60 feet wide by 1,200 feet long and 15 feet deep. The fire sparked at the 511-foot mark and covered about a 30-foot area, Romo said. Several fire department members, along with a pumper, several brush trucks, a tanker, as well as a county tanker, were all on scene to combat the blaze. Quote, "It was a good-sized fire. We began putting water on the fire and just trying to contain it and keep it from spreading out any further. The city brought out a loader to the pit to put down some dirt in order to smother the fire," Monahan's volunteer fire department chief Randy Crabtree said. City manager Rex Thies said the fire was minor, and because it was extinguished within 48 hours, there was no need to notify TCEQ of the event. Quote, "TCEQ requires water and dirt at all work sites, which the landfill has, and because level 4 waste is compacted and covered with dirt every week, the fire would not be able to burn for very long," he added. In a Tuesday afternoon phone call, Romo told the news smoke was no longer coming from the pit and the west end of the pit would be closed for a while. Quote, "We will use the east end for a while until we are sure that the west end is safe to use again," Romo said.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.